Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, biographer Marshall Terrell, actress Tana Frederick, and composer Jeff Beal. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Geeks United, everybody. Glad to have you guys on board. Jamie and Jerry here with you. How
hey,
you doing,
up?
Jerry?
What's going on?
What is going on? How's your weekend been, man?
It's been all right. You know, very, very quiet, very mellow. How about you?
Very good. I considered this weekend, or Friday at least, I thought it should have been a national holiday since there was a new Pacino film out. But I couldn't convince the place of my employment to consider it the same. But I did go see Righteous Kill Friday night, as did you, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, I did see it, yes.
And you also saw the Coen Brothers new film.
I saw
so
the
Coen
Brothers.
I liked
a lot more than the Pacino and De Niro movie. But
oh,
they're
good.
Totally different beasts. So that's,
you give us a little teaser before we actually review it later on the show.
Yes.
So we will review those two films at the end of the show. Two very interesting films. Burn After Reading opened up number one this weekend. Edging out Tyler Perry's new film by a hair.
Yeah, it was a really too close to call, it looked like, on Friday and Saturday. Initial reports on Friday had Tyler Perry ahead.
Right, yeah, Friday's always surprising. The top grossing films Friday frequently aren't the top grossing films for the whole week.
Right.
I found, yeah, people go see different things. I guess Friday's probably kids' night, Saturday's adult. I don't know what to attribute it to, but we have a great show for you tonight, and our first guest is on the line, so let's get it started. Want to remind people that you can log on to our chat room. If you click the chat available icon on the home page there, you will be taken directly to our chat room where you can talk all things film and all the subjects that we discuss on the show. You can put in your two cents. You can submit questions for our guests through that chat room. It's a great time in there, so I highly recommend you do that. All right, our first guest. He was the very essence of cinematic cool, and I'm speaking, of course, of actor Steve McQueen, who is and will forever remain one of the all-time great screen icons. Tonight's guest spent over 3.5 years researching the actor for his groundbreaking autobiography. I can't read today, I'm so sorry. For his groundbreaking biography, Steve McQueen, Portrait of an American Rebel, which has enjoyed universal praise, 4 printings, and has spawned numerous documentaries, including 2007's An American Rebel from filmmaker Richard Martin. Other outstanding works in Mr. Terrell's resume include 2 other McQueen-themed books, The Last Mile and The King McQueen and the Love Machine, as well as Sergeant Presley, a portrait of Elvis Presley during his period of military service. It is a great pleasure to have to the show Mr. Marshall Terrell. Mr. Terrell, are you with us?
I'm with you. Thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Thank you for being with us tonight. I appreciate you coming on. I read something very interesting about you. Let's talk a little bit about your journey before we get into Mr. McQueen. You came from the financial world, actually, I read, working under Charles Keating, and then when that didn't work out, you started writing, and was writing always a goal for you?
No, actually, like you'd said, I had planned a career in the business field, and for some reason, that's my other phone going off. I was a business major in college, and so when I worked for Charles Keating, I was in college and, you know, thought I was just going to have a life in business and, you know, thought I was going to have it all mapped out. And then, And then, of course, the whole savings and loan industry went under in the late 80s, and Charles Keating went to jail, and then I was kind of out of a job. And, you know, I was kind of forced to ask myself, what is it that I want to do in life? And writing that biography of Steve McQueen was the one thing I had always wanted to do, even though I had never taken on a literary endeavor before.
Right.
So it just kind of came out of left field, and when I told my friends and my family I was doing it, they all kind of chuckled and laughed and said, "What would you want to do a thing like that for?"
Yeah, yeah, but there hadn't been any comprehensive work on McQueen's life, had there, prior to
that? No, not to that point. There had been, I think, 5 books written, but they all kind of focused on different sections of his life. So I kind of saw where that one big comprehensive work hadn't been done yet, and I saw where there was just this groundswell of McQueen fans just dying for something. For example, last year I did a book on Pistol Pete Maravich, the basketball player. I felt the same thing. And then, of course, boom, two books on the life of Pistol Pete come out at the same time. So, you know, there's just a certain feel that you get for artists who, you know, even though they've passed away, they're going to get their review. And I felt that about McQueen at that time. And when the book came out, the movie The Getaway came out at the same time, and McQueen
right.
started making his way back into the mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah, your dad loved McQueen. Is that who you inherited your love from?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, it was funny. Whenever there was a McQueen movie that came out, he'd take me out of school and we'd go see McQueen together, you know? So you talk about a special day and a special memory, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anything to get you out of school to go to the movies is awesome in my book.
So, you know, that is just a special memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me what his, you know, obviously he's always referred to as the king of cool or the essence of cool. What was his screen persona? What made him special? What was that identity with McQueen?
To me, there was a lot of different things, and I think people who are McQueen fans pick up on this, and that is, you know, go beyond the cool, you study his acting, and you see that here's a guy who can convey so many thoughts and ideas with just a look, and that truly is a gift. I mean, there aren't too many people that I can think of that are like that, and nobody certainly did it as well as McQueen. Then you take into account the fact that, you know, he had tried to portray himself as somebody that he really was not. And in his personal life, he was so deeply insecure. And when you saw that image on the screen, well, you thought, well, naturally, he's that guy. And so he was that guy, but then there was this completely other side to McQueen as well. And that's what makes him so intriguing.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into the off-screen McQueen.
Okay.
But you mentioned his acting chops, and I believe it's actually seen in the documentary that I mentioned, based on your book,
right.
And in your book as well. That the thing that I always strikes me is that scene in Bullet with Vaughn in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and that he cut out pages of dialogue, and he said, "I can just do this in a look."
Mm-hmm. Right.
That kind of power. I mean, his face held a camera. Unlike anyone else, amazing stuff.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that he was doing at the time, nobody else was doing. And, you know, even though McQueen had some acting in New York, I mean, he really developed as a film star and a screen star when he took the series Wanted Dead or Alive, and he used that series to experiment. And so he was the only actor that at the time was basically cutting his own dialogue and saying less, less, less. And it completely worked for him. And today, you see a lot of actors now doing the same.
Yeah, there's tremendous power in that.
Yeah.
The best actors, you know who's a great actor when they can be still and you're drawn to them.
Well, and he gave Chuck Norris some great advice when Chuck was first starting out. Chuck's first film, I forget what it was, but you know, he made McQueen watch it, and afterwards Norris said, "That's the worst film ever." And McQueen said, "Well, it's not bad, but let me tell you what you can do." And this is advice I use in my writing. He basically said, "Let your screen actors fill in the plot." And then when there's something really important to say, then you say it. Because that way, people remember what you say. And I apply the same theory in my writing, and that is, you know, let other people fill in kind of who Steve McQueen was. And then if you have to use a quote from McQueen, then use it in the right spot. And
yeah.
So it's just amazing that here's a guy who had a ninth grade education but had these wonderful instincts and used that, and it completely worked to his advantage. You know, today he is the most widely emulated actor that's in Hollywood today. I mean, everybody wants to be the next Steve McQueen.
Which brings up the question I had about that. There are always actors that come along, as you said. I remember them saying that about George Clooney. After Out of Sight, he's the next Steve McQueen, which is a ridiculous, you know, the next anything is pretty ridiculous. All of us are individuals. But does anybody strike that mold for you from today's crop of actors?
You know, I get asked that question a lot. It's hard to answer because everybody is trying to be McQueen. But I guess the person that came closest in my mind, and you may laugh, was Kevin Costner. He took on a lot of McQueen-like roles. He wasn't as tough. He was never as tough as McQueen, but he's a natural actor, and people give him a lot of grief. But if you look at the movies he makes, and you know, his movies of late aren't great, but you look at his early film catalog, like Bull Durham and No Way Out and Revenge, especially Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Revenge. He reminds you a lot of McQueen.
Yeah. I see it. I can definitely see it in Revenge and even The Untouchables and No Way Out, definitely.
Yeah, and he's spoken to his admiration for McQueen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's blatant.
Go ahead.
It's blatant, especially in The Bodyguard.
Well, that was written. I mean, wasn't that written originally for McQueen?
That was originally written for McQueen in 1977. It was written for he and Diana Ross. And for some reason, either McQueen passed or just never got into his hands. And it just had floated through Hollywood for years. I think it was offered to Ryan O'Neill and then Diana Ross and then just stayed dormant. And then Costner picked it up. And then, boom, it was a $400 million hit, his biggest movie to date.
Yeah. Obviously, he was a big star, a tremendous star. Did he feel underappreciated as an actor, though?
That's an interesting question. The research that I dug up was basically that McQueen was playing himself. Now, I don't know if McQueen ever really felt that he was maybe, you know, the answer to that question is he didn't really pay attention to what the critics had to say. He paid attention to what the fans paid at the box office.
Mm.
And so he knew that he was the best reactor in film business. He had said that to actor Peter Yates, who had told that to me. And yet I feel like there was a lot of insecurity on his part that he wasn't truly appreciated, but he was a tremendous movie star. And the critics in their day were dead wrong about McQueen and his acting because they had felt that he was playing himself, and truly he wasn't, because he was a totally different person in real life.
I can't say he was playing himself. If you just look at the variety of roles, like you're going to tell me he's playing himself in The Sand Pebbles and The Getaway or The Great
Thomas Crown Affair.
The Thomas Crown Affair, The Cincinnati Kid, The Soldier in the Rain. I mean, he's not playing. That's narrow-mindedness on the critic's part. I always found that. I mean, his characters, even if you look at his greatest roles, there are distinct differences in each of those that add to it.
Absolutely, and yet there were sections of his personality in those roles. Otherwise, he wouldn't have taken them on. You know, for example, in The Cincinnati Kid, you know, and that was so beautiful about his acting was that he really was some of those people. In that, you know, The Cincinnati Kid, he had played cards in New York to supplement his income. And in The Sand Pebbles, you know, he knew how to take apart an engine. So he knew machinery. In The Getaway, you know, he had military training, so he knew how to handle guns. So, I mean, there was such a realism that he injected in his roles. But there was some of McQueen in there. But again, I think we all agree that the critics wrote him off way too easily in his lifetime.
I must ask Mr. Terrell, I'm sure you have, the 2000 movie, The Dallas Steve. Have you ever seen that?
I did see it.
It's a wonderful movie.
Love that movie, yes.
And it just, I think it, I just love the, you know, here in 2000, people are still, you know, raving about Steve McQueen. Made me go home and watch The Getaway again for the millionth time, I think, but after watching it. But it's just, I just love that the impact he has. I mean, especially today, you know, the impact is still there, you know, in this age of the internet and everything. And people are still, you know, gung-ho for him. I think it's wonderful.
Well, and it's interesting in that when I first wrote my book in 93, we were just starting to get around to that. It wasn't always that way. Sometimes it takes 15 to 20 years for somebody's legend to form. And so now you're seeing McQueen kind of hitting his full stride now. He's made more now dead in endorsements than he ever did in his lifetime, and he was the highest paid actor of his time, so that really says a lot. His estate makes about $10 million in endorsements a year.
What would be your choice for the definitive McQueen performance?
I would have to say Papillon.
Really, choice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this really truly shows an Oscar-winning actor. Even though he didn't win the Oscar for that role, it was Jack Lemmon in Save the Tiger, which is a movie that a lot of people have never heard of. You see a real acting tour de force with McQueen. I mean, he really pushed himself, and he was really believable. And, you know, there's no other way to put it. In my opinion, he danced circles around Dustin Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
True,
mm-hmm.
True.
And he worked with some tremendous people. You mentioned Dustin Hoffman and some great directors, Norman Jewison, and on. How was he as a collaborator?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in the early portion of his career, yes, he was, you know, he was eager to please. And then, of course, as he became a star, he became harder and a little bit more difficult to work with. You know, John Sturges was the guy, if you could pinpoint any guy that was really responsible for McQueen having a career, it was him. You know, he gave McQueen his first shot in a big movie, which was Never So Few, and he followed that with a big co-starring role in The Magnificent Seven, and, of course, his breakthrough role in The Great Escape. And then, you know, you fast forward 7 years later when they're making Le Mans, and Steve basically pays no attention to him and is quite disrespectful to him, and their relationship is severed. So, you know, he changed. You know, it happens in Hollywood. When a star gets bigger and their head gets bigger, their personality changes. And McQueen was no different.
And you say that he was insecure off screen. How did that manifest itself in his life?
Well, in his life, it manifested itself in his personal relationships with people, especially with women. You know, in the movie, he was the calm, cool, collected guy who always got the women, and he did in real life too. But in his relationships, he was terribly insecure. But the interesting thing is that he used that in his role. He channeled that energy into his movie roles. I mean, he was never. He was never secure in his place in Hollywood, and yet he used that edge really in his film roles, and you see that, you know. And if people know that history. They know that, for example, when he finished Bullet, you know, it was probably one of the highest grossing films of all time at that time, and his next role was The Reavers, and he had told his friend Robert Relyea. On a plane, they were going to receive an award for him being the biggest box office attraction in the world. And The Reavers was going to be comedy, and he told Relyea that, you know, this role is probably going to doom me, and it'll probably be the end of me. And he says, What are you talking about? And he said, well, comedy, you know, I've never been able to really tackle it. And when people see me in this role, I'll be finished. And he had to remind him that they were going to Washington, D.C. to pick up this National Theater's award winner statue, so that you know, he was the number one box office star in the world, and yet so he couldn't shake that insecurity no matter how big he got.
Wow.
I always felt that story was really interesting and really told of Steve in his personal life.
Yeah. And you did another Steve McQueen work after that with his widow Barbara, called the Last Mile.
Right.
What was that journey like, going through that journey with Barbara?
Well, it was interesting because Barbara was always the one person that I always wanted to talk to. You know, for the first book, the two wives, Neil, the first one, and then Alan McGraw had already come out with their books. but Barbara had never talked about Steve. So that was a part of his life that he was very quiet and there was very little research on. And so in talking to her, she was able to shed light on those 3 years, which was basically 1977 to 1980. After the Towering Inferno, he basically, you know, just retired from the movie industry. And people always wondered, well, what did he do in that time? And Barbara shed light on the fact that, well, he rode his motorcycles. They hopped in the truck and they drove to Montana and Utah and they just kind of toured the country. And he grew a beard and grew his hair long and kind of went incognito throughout the United States, which is, I thought, was a pretty cool story.
Yeah, yeah. And you can picture McQueen doing that. I mean, that's the kind of the McQueen image I've always had in my head.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you're working on a photo book for next year, Steve McQueen, a tribute to the King of Cool. What in a 2010 revision,
yes,
or yeah, of the Portrait of an American Rebel?
Right.
What is there new to discover about McQueen that has surprised you? I mean, you spent 3.5 years in research for that,
yeah,
initial printing. What else has come to light for you about him?
Well, a lot of things. When in these past 2 years, the Steve McQueen in Slater, they've had what they call Steve McQueen Days, which is a celebration. His hometown has now finally kind of gotten the fact that, okay, Steve McQueen is a worldwide icon. And we should be celebrating this man. And so the last 2 years I've gone back to Slater and I've actually talked to people who knew Steve as a kid, shed some insight into his past, and was able through in the last year or two, I think they released his military records. So now we know exactly where he went to in his military career. I mean, there was still kind of a vague picture of what he was doing. And then as Barbara McQueen and I were doing these book signings in art exhibits, people would come up to us out of the blue and said, yeah, hey, I knew Steve, and here's my story. And so along the way, I recorded their stories as well. And so, you know, what I'm getting now is a fuller picture of what I had before. What the tribute book is basically is it's passages written by people who either knew him or had like a one-time dealing with him or an association with him, and it's set to all these pictures that haven't been seen before. So it's not just photos, it's memories of people who actually knew him, had encounters with him. And so all that, of course, will be combined in the revised version of the book. And the reason why I'm doing the revised version of the book is because people are still yearning for more information about Steve McQueen.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's a never-ending yearning to feel closer to those people we consider icons, and
yes,
that's certainly a value of the biographical form. What are some other values of the biography for you, and why are you compelled to write them?
That is an interesting question. To me, they're like the ultimate jigsaw puzzle. You know, that takes years to put together. For example, this book I did on Pete Maravich took me 7 years. I interviewed 300 people, and it took me 2 years alone just to transcribe the 300 interviews. And for reasons I can't even begin to tell you, I don't know why I do it. I'm just,
yeah,
for some reason, I'm compelled. But I'm compelled to tell the story of the people that moved me. And Steve McQueen certainly moved me. I know that he moved a lot of people. It's not just about a movie star. It's about a guy who had almost this mythological life, you know, who,
right,
ran away with the carnival at age 14. When I went back, you know, when I heard that, I thought, well, that sounds a little too mythological. But indeed, it turned out to be true. He did,
yeah,
run away with the circus. And then, you know, he did become a lumberjack, and he did all these things, which I think really added to his work. You know, there are some things they can teach you in film school and in acting classes, but there's nothing like real life experiences. And
yeah,
that's what Steve McQueen brought to the screen.
Yeah. Tell me about Authors for Sale. What is Authors for Sale?
Well, that's what, over the years, I've had people approach me saying, you know, will you read my manuscript? Will you do this? Will you help me out? And, you know, what I found is basically that takes time. And, The one thing that people really need in order to finish a manuscript is actually to get a good editor, because a lot of people don't want to put their work in other people's hands, and you have to if you're going to submit that work to a publisher. So that's basically what that service is an editing service.
From the time that you started writing, this was this around the period of 92, 93 when you wrote this first book on McQueen?
Right. Yeah, I started initial research in 89.
To now, how have you grown as a writer? Can you detect that growth in your own work?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so much better, and that's really kind of one of the reasons why I want to rewrite that first book. I remember John Lennon in an interview in 1980 before he died, basically saying, you know, the interview asked him if you could rewrite or redo all your Beatles songs, would you? And he said yes. And when I read that at the time, it blew me away because I thought, well, these songs are perfect, but
yeah.
They're not perfect. They're not perfect to him. And so that first book is not perfect to me, and it gives me another shot at wanting to rewrite that book, because to me, I've gotten so much better.
Yeah, it's a tremendous work and a tremendous value for you to bring Steve McQueen into the film fans' lives in a way that we haven't considered him before, and I appreciate it greatly. And several of your books are there on our homepage. If you click on the icons of the front covers of these books, it'll take you to Amazon where you can purchase them for all of our live listeners out there and our replay listeners. Mr. Terrell, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been a great pleasure, and we'd love to have you on sometime in the future.
Hey, anytime. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you very much, buddy.
Take care.
Bye-bye, sir. That's Marshall Terrell. His book is Steve McQueen, Portrait of an American Rebel, and obviously some other works on McQueen and Elvis Presley that we have there on our homepage. It really, the biography, I mean, it's fascinating to read about life journeys, and it does humanize the subject, but it also gives, you know, you can also learn some things about yourself, I think, reflected
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
the stories of others. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think there's great value in it. I love reading political biographies, you know, just
yeah, political biographies are great, but I gotta check out his books on McQueen, because you're right. Before these, I mean, there really wasn't much on him. And the documentary that was on a couple of years ago, that was on Turner Classic Movies, was very enlightening.
Yeah,
about him. And there's stuff on there towards the end of his career I had no idea about.
Right.
Like, I didn't know about Tom Horn, Enemy of the People. That was alien to me. So, because
mm-hmm.
when I think of his end of the career, I think of the movie where he's the bounty hunter, the hunter.
And we spoke to the novelist that wrote that book.
Yeah. And I always think of that. That's what I think of. You know, I always think then, did he go down to Mexico to
mm-hmm.
seek treatment for his cancer? There's a big deal with the U.S. doctors, but he wanted to go down to treatment in Mexico.
He went for experimental treatment in Mexico, and then you can't really blame him because he was given a death sentence. I mean, he was given months to live, so why not?
Right.
My dad was
an oncologist, and he made a big stink about that when that was going on in the news. And that was, I'll never forget that, because that was when I hear his name. I remember this whole period towards the end of his life because he was in the news a lot. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm given a death sentence, I'll go to Iraq for experimental treatment.
Okay, great.
Why not?
Jamie DeVal, I have complete faith in the Iraqi healthcare system. Oh, my God. You heard it here first, folks.
I'm sorry.
Who said the surge just worked.
Yes. Well, yeah, so it's interesting, and he's iconic. Steve McQueen is an icon, and icons by, you know, just the nature of that
mm-hmm. yeah.
Iconography. You can't get close to them. You know, they're up there on the pedestal and untouchable in a sense, unknowable really. And so these books are very valuable.
Yes,
in
they
case
are.
Of Steve McQueen, it doesn't diminish that his qualities.
No, not at all. No, I don't
yeah.
think. He'll always be, you know, when I think of McQueen, obviously, of course, the things in Bullet, the car chase in Bullet, the motorcycle, riding the motorcycle, escaping from the Nazis and the Great
mm-hmm.
Escape. But there's mm-hmm. also other stuff. There are great moments in The Getaway,
yeah.
Which is just and both the things he made with Peck and Paul, that and Junior Bonner. I mean, there's just beautiful moments in that, the Sand Pebbles with Candice Bergen. I mean, there's just tons of beautiful moments in his career.
Yeah. Welcome to the chat room, all of our friends out there, including Running with the Pack, Kismet, Jason O'Brien. Hello, Jason O'Brien. We've been talking about Steve McQueen for the past half hour with his biographer, Marshall Terrell. And it's been a great discussion of a classic artist. And welcome all the live listeners out there, too. I encourage you to visit our chat room. These people are real characters in there. but don't talk to Jason O'Brien.
Come on. Jason's all right. He said hi to Kismet. Okay, all right, there, yes. He's there.
Yes. We're waiting for our second guest to call in, Henry Jaglom, legendary director that she has had the pleasure of collaborating with several times
His protege. This is his
muse.
Protege.
Yeah. Something very exciting about, and anyone that checked out our blog and bulletin postings about tonight's show is aware of this. We were supposed to have Jeff Beal, the composer of great works, his latest is Appaloosa, the Ed Harris Western, on last Sunday. But we had technical difficulties last Sunday.
Yeah, we're calling him underwater.
Yeah, right. So he's calling back in tonight to speak with us. Tremendous artist, and this is honestly my favorite soundtrack of the year. And he actually won an Emmy last night for his score for The Company, the miniseries The Company. And so he's fresh off an Emmy win, man, and we're having him on the show, so that'll be great. He sent us a picture. He snapped a picture when he walked back to his seat with the Emmy in his hand and sent it to us. And
awesome. That was so cool.
Yeah, that's great. I think this is his fourth Emmy, actually, for composing work. He's quite accomplished, and we're going to actually premiere the title track from the Appaloosa score during that interview. So that's something to look forward to. And the second interview of the show, obviously we've all been looking forward to this one as well, and let's get started. Tana Frederick is definitely an actress on the rise, and that rise from her home state of Iowa to the glittering beacon of Hollywood is a textbook example of undeterred passion for the art and the forging of relationships that could result in that big break. For Tana, that good fortune came in the form of legendary filmmaker Henry Jaglom. There's no doubt that her story is the stuff of Hollywood dreams, which incidentally is the title and the theme of one of her latest film projects with Jaglom. In the film, she delivers a ferocious performance that has been touted by critics as Oscar-worthy. And another collaboration with Jaglom, titled Irene in Time, is currently slated for a December 12th release. Perhaps the most telling insight into Miss Frederick's immense talents come from Jaglom himself. "What acting is all about is listening and being present," he said. And that is what Tana has moment by moment on film. She is moving and funny, and her instincts are great. She doesn't lie to the camera, so she is a director's dream. It is a great pleasure to have this director's dream on our show tonight, actress Tana Frederick. Tana, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome.
That,
welcome
I
to
think
Movie Geeks
like
United.
The, what?
Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Oh, thank you. That was the nicest intro I think that anybody's ever given me. That was beautiful. I just want to cry now. That was so nice.
You came to the right place. You came to the right place.
Yeah. Let's just take a moment to compose ourselves now.
Okay. All
right. To tell me a little bit about you. You came from Iowa.
Yep, I did.
Who were your early influences? When did this bug hit you?
Really, really young. I think probably nine years old. Iowa has an immensely amazing artistic community there. I mean, there's the arts, the theater, music, everything, and really supportive people, supportive community of the arts, and so there was a beautiful children's theater in my hometown, and I went to see Oliver Twist, and my best friend was playing Oliver, and I just remember sitting in the audience and thinking, this was what I was destined for the rest of my life. So I joined the children's theater the next year and started doing, you know, 4 to 5 shows a year, and then just kept on going from there.
Yeah, it really does strike you like a lightning bolt. I mean, all of a sudden you know that's your passion in life.
Yeah, there was never any question for me, and I always felt really lucky lucky about that, because I know that some people struggle with what they want to do and what their passion is. But for me, it was never a question. It was just, you know, an obsession.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is how it should be. Now, where did you go to New York? Did you go to L.A.? Where did you study?
I went to the University of Iowa because my parents said you have to get a good college education before you go. I wanted to come right out to Los Angeles, but they did make me go to college, where I graduated in with a double major in political science and theater, with honors in both, and actually the valedictorian of my liberal arts class there, which was kind of cool, if I may brag about myself.
Wow. No, go brag away. I barely graduated high school, so this is terrific.
Well, you know, I've forgotten everything that I learned in college, I think. But then right after I graduated, I packed up my little Honda Civic and I drove out to Los Angeles. And my car broke down in Denver, Colorado, and got it fixed by my uncle, and then drove the rest of the way at like 35 miles an hour. But I was bound and determined to get out here, and then I slept on a couple people's couches and waited tables and just kept working.
Yeah, and tell me about that work and the value of that struggle for you. What did you learn about yourself, and what did you learn about the craft as you were going through that?
Oh my gosh, I learned so much. That's a really good question. It was really terrifying because you know, you pride yourself so much on academics, and I think so many people do, and you know, in an incredibly unconventional field where you have your entire family, friends, community, you know, sort of disappointed in you that you took off and went to Los Angeles and thinking that you're following a pipe dream, you learn that you just have to shut out every voice, you know, no matter how close, no matter how much you love those people, you can't listen, or it's just going to detract you. You know, you're going to give up. It's so easy to give up out here. It's so easy. There were so many hurdles and so many scary, terrifying experiences that, you know, you just have to shut everything out and find people who support you. And even if it's one person out here who supports you, then you can keep going. But, you know, it was tough for 5 years. It was really a struggle. It was really a struggle having like 7 jobs at once and, you know, like demeaning auditions and it was tough. But I learned how strong I was, I guess.
Sure, I would think so. And you had a support system, if I understand correctly from a previous interview you did, of fellow actors that were struggling right along with you, that kind of community, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a great acting class that I was in out here called the Beverly Hills Playhouse. And it was really an amazing place where a really strong some of the classes out here I think are a little bit flighty, and this class particularly had the sort of integrity and work ethic that I was used to, you know, coming from a farming community in Iowa where it's, you know, you get there 5 minutes before class, you're never late, you there's you know, instructions to follow. You have to write so many letters to so many directors, so many letters to casting directors, and you have people who check in with you every week to make sure you're doing that. And really just looked at it like a business instead of sort of just, you know, trying to pass my headshots out just randomly. It streamlined what I was doing and really helped me out.
We've talked about that so many times on the show that you have to be of both mindsets, the obviously creative people. You know, they're using that portion of their brain, whichever portion that is, but you also have to be of the business mindset too, because it is a business, and sometimes those notions are set so much at odds with one another in terms of personality.
I think it's always a business out here, and you know, you're lucky if you get 3%, I think, of your time, if you get 3%, that you are actually, you know, acting, or you are creating something artistically, or you know, you're lucky. 97% of the time, it's business. It's just formulating the next, you know, the next career move, and being in pre-production, and you know, there are those lucky people who just go from from project to project to project, but that's, there's so very few of them. So you really have to love, I think, have a passion for the business side as well as definitely as the acting side.
Yeah. You mentioned writing letters to directors.
Mm-hmm.
And you had written a letter to Mr. Jaglom without having seen any of his films.
Tell me
what inspired you to choose to write to him, and what were the contents of that letter?
I was in a play out here, and one of the cast members came to rehearsal and said, I just have the best day of filming with this brilliant director, Henry Jaglom, and I've wanted to work with him forever, and he's one of the legendary independent filmmakers of all time. And I said, well, how can I work with him? And he said, well, he's a sucker for anybody who writes him a letter and tells him how brilliant his films are. And he gave me, the actor gave me a film, Deja Vu, that Henry had done. And then I watched the opening credits. And that night wrote a 3-page single-spaced letter to Henry saying how much I adored his film. And, you know, I spoke as vaguely as possible. It was so, your film was so commercial, yet so independently driven. And it was charming, yet it was dark. And, you know, it was a really good letter. But then, you know, I had just come out of college writing all those, you know, thesis papers. And so anyway, he loved the letter and he called me in, and that's how I met him. And he called me into a screening, and then I saw his film Festival in Cannes, and really it was very serendipitous because it really was my niche. It really, luckily, you know, by BSing my way, I found my little area in Hollywood that I connect with and that I work well in.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly, you first collaborated with him on a play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was his. Sorry.
No, ahead. and you just recently did another one with him called Always. And what I was curious about is, you've worked with him in film on stage. Is there a difference between the directions he gives? I know the differences between the actual discipline of acting on stage and film. But is the direction any different? Does he modulate it at all?
Well, to be honest, he didn't. I've done 3 plays with him now. Two were films of his that were he converted into plays. But I've hired directors for those, or I found a production company that's hired directors, because Henry actually does not like directing theater, because, you know, he. And it's really interesting to watch because, you know, he's kind of known as a director who will have somewhat of an ad hoc, somewhat completed script and then let his actors go. He always has, you know, really brilliant improvisational actors in his films. And when he does a play, it was really interesting because I had heard how great he was with just letting actors go on film, you know, when he's directing. But when I did this first play with him, A Safe Place, he was there every single night, just about every single night of this 3-month run of this play in Los Angeles, correcting my A, ands, and thes. I mean, he was there saying that was supposed to be plural. And I mean, he was a total stickler about his words and his script, which is really interesting. It makes me wonder what Woody Allen would be like if, you know, directing theater, but it was
just did an opera. You just directed an opera of all things.
Really?
Yes.
What was it?
It just opened in L.A. I think it was he and William Friedkin. It's a triple bill of opera in L.A. And Woody Allen directed one of them. Yeah.
Wow.
I
had no
idea.
He was
just walking around saying, "I'm so out of my element." I mean, he always speaks like that. He's always wonderful, but he's very funny. But on film, in these film performances that you've given to him, what does he give you as an actress that you find unique?
He stays out of the actor's way, and I think that's the most amazing gift that you can give an actor. When I first got out here, you know, there's so many people who want to pigeonhole you. There's so many acting classes out here that are about, you know, how to succeed in an audition, how to succeed, you know, in television, and these acting classes that you take just completely, like, flatten your voice, flatten your instincts, you know, and everybody tells you, and everybody told me, you're too big, you're too big, you're too big. And And I was so tired of being told that. And then Henry really just said, loved what I did and just let me go on film. You know, he said, you're never too big. If you are too big, I'll edit it out. But just be yourself. And he really let me explore and show my colors and run the gamut of emotions in the films. And I never felt blocked in. And I think he does that with everybody.
Yeah, and you hear that a lot. It's freedom and trust are two qualities that actors really appreciate from a director.
Yeah.
And
Hollywood, he has such a passion.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go.
Yeah.
He has such a passion for acting, I think, coming from the Actors Studio and having worked with Strasberg and Klerman and, you know, seeing all of these actors, you know, Paul Newman, and he was in class with Marilyn Monroe, and he came from this very, like, beautiful, fundamental place of acting, of truthful acting, and people who really respected and studied the craft. So I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah, and it was a real kind of golden age of, and speaking of the golden age of Hollywood, tell me about Hollywood Dreams. What are we talking about here? What's this film about?
It's about a girl from Iowa who comes out to Hollywood to be with the goal of being famous. very shallow aspirations, but she's down on her luck in the first, third of the film, sleeping on some girls, on their couch, and then she runs into two managers, Zach Norman and David Provall. And David Provall from The Sopranos, and Zach's done several of Henry's other films, and they're two gay managers. They have this management team and this great stable of actors. And so they end up picking her up as the next star, and and they let her live in their guest house, and then she meets Justin Kirk, who's, I think, a brilliant actor from...
He is terrific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's amazing. Yeah, Angels in America blew me away. Uh-huh. And in the film, in Hollywood Dreams, he's posing... He's a straight actor posing as gay to get ahead in the business, and he sort of made a name for himself. And so trouble starts when my character Margie and he fall in love, and it's that whole struggle of love or work, you know, which they can't coexist. So you have to choose one or the other, and you have to watch a movie to see which one I pick.
Okay, fair enough.
but you spoke to something when you described the movie, and you actually spoke to it when you described Mr. Jagelman's way of working. It seems that for some portion of the film, a lot of your life informs the journey that that character goes through.
Yeah, it was. I was able to use some of my own personal experiences and just sort of blow them up in this sort of neurotic, messy way. With the character that I was playing, because, you know, my character Margie, I don't know, have you seen the film?
I haven't been able to see it. I ordered it as soon as I knew we were booking you on the show.
I'll have to send you one.
Send me one, please.
You guys will get 25 in the next week.
Any listeners out there want a copy of Hollywood Dreams, hit her up now for it.
It's worth
absolutely.
It. It's a very good director, so it's worth it.
Yeah, he is amazing, and it was, yeah, Henry, he asked me, you know, he likes to draw from the character, he lets, you know, it's Justin Kirk also, you know, a lot of people thought he had this misconception that he was gay, and he had actually done Boys in the Band and Love, Valor, and Compassion and Angels in America, but Justin's actually straight, and so, you know, Henry likes to take people's personal stories and then use them, you know, let the character build itself from people and their own history. So while a part of it is, you know, I come from Iowa, I'm desperate, you know, it's still a bigger version of myself. And although it was really therapeutic to take some of the experiences that happened to me out here and put them into film and be able to watch them now and laugh at them. That was good.
I would imagine so. I heard that you prepared this. You had something like 2 years before you could get the project off the ground. In that time, I heard that he had you watch a slew of films from the 30s and 40s, and I'm wondering what you were after from these films and which films and performances in particular struck you.
Oh, gosh, that whole era struck me. I mean, I didn't know. I knew that a lot of Henry's films had that foundation, that he is just like a connoisseur of the golden Hollywood's golden era, you know. But I was watching, he would assign me, literally give me huge lists of films, and then just for 2 years I watched 2 to 3 films from the 30s and 40s a day. And
wow.
Probably more, I'm exaggerating, in a year. It was probably like a little over a year. But to see the freedom that those actresses had, and the freedom and the largeness of their performances, and yet the reality that they kept, they always had underneath, you know, Betty Davis and Garbo, and they always had, you know, their emotions rang so true, yet they gave these very big, bold performances because they did come from the stage, and because they, you know, it was so big was still heralded then, and I loved that, and I let that inform the character, because my character in Hollywood Dreams is obsessed with the 40s, and so her perception of herself and of success is to have that sort of lifestyle, to have a personality that's bigger than life and is like these women, you know, this romantic notion of a diva from the 40s, and gosh, it was that's the most, I think it's one of the most amazing years of my life, actually, to have read all of those biographies and autobiographies, and it's sad to me that sometimes those films get lost, and you ask a 14-year-old, you know, who Jimmy Stewart is, and they don't know. I mean, it's just
sad. Very sad.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
I remember a conversation in high school where I was talking about Jimmy Stewart, because I was doing Harvey in high school, and I said, "Yeah, Jimmy Stewart, the film Harvey." And they said, "Who's Jimmy Stewart?" And I went through this run of films, and then finally I had to say, "The guy that does the voiceover of the Campbell's Soup commercials." And they were like, "Oh, Jimmy Stewart."
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I thought you would have to say Airport 77 or something like that.
No, they wouldn't remember that.
Oh my God!
Is there a good backtrack for a second? I just have
sure.
a question to ask you about the Beverly Hills Playhouse, because I
mm-hmm.
actually know of this place. I used to walk by it all the time. And Jorge Garcia, who plays Hurley on Lost, I believe.
I have a story. I love Jorge.
I used to work with him, and he had insisted, because I was interested in acting when I lived out there, and he had insisted, if I had stayed out there, I would have probably gone there. He said,
wow.
Of all the places I was looking at, he's like, dude, you'll like this place. It's like right up your alley. And it's,
absolutely.
He said, for someone who knows nothing, you know, someone who doesn't have any experience, he said, this is where you would want to go.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's the most amazing place. It really jump-started, like, my career. I mean, it just really turned me upside down. It is the best place, I think, for actors to go when they first get out here. And you know, the funny thing about Jorge is, in a safe place, it's really interesting to me to see the people who are successful in this town, because it's always the people with the best attitudes who show up and are excited to do whatever job
mm-hmm.
that they get. You know, Jorge had 3 lines in A Safe Place, and he was hilarious. He was so, I mean, it was while he just booked his job on Becker, and
mm-hmm.
so, you know, it's a whole bunch of us in this cast, and he played this tiny small part in A Safe Place, at the first play that I did of Henry's that ran for 3 months that I was talking about. But he had just booked his job on Becker and was telling us how he was driving onto the CBS lot and working with Ted Danson, and, you know, but nonetheless, he showed up at every performance.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up on fire and never did he
very
just
polite.
Had a great attitude.
He was very polite, very friendly, very, you know, always eager to help, always eager just to talk. You know, if you had any questions, boom, he was there. Always.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
really
and
great.
There's that
spirit.
There's that childlike glee about being able to do to invest in your passion and actually go out there and do it. That I think. You know, just hold on to that at all costs. Just whatever you have to do to hold on to that, I think it's very valuable.
That's one thing that Henry always says that really sticks with me is, he says, whenever it stops being fun, I'm not going to do it. If it stops being fun, I refuse to do it. I never want this to be like a job. And, you know, that's the one thing. It's such a tough business, but you have to maintain that sense of play and you know, joy and, like you said, the glee that that comes along with just going after it and being in the game and being in Hollywood and trying to, you know, gambling your all of your chances on one audition. And you have to love all of it. And just that was the point at which I think things started happening for me, is the point that I just said, you know what, screw it. This is all a game. It's all fun. And if I don't have fun, like Henry says, then I'm not going to do it anymore. And and that just turned everything around.
Yeah. I just want to note that you're about to go into production of the sequel of sorts to Hollywood Dreams, which is called
mm-hmm.
Queen of the Lot.
Yep.
And December 12th sees the release of your latest collaboration with Mr. Jaglom, Irene in Time. What can
mm-hmm.
you tell us about Irene in Time?
That's it's a completely different character from Hollywood Dreams. My character in Hollywood Dreams was, I think one of the critics said, like Betty Davis on crack, which I think is pretty accurate. And when you see it, you'll be like, oh God, she's a fruitcake. I mean, I've walked out of theaters and men have actually jumped back. You know, I've walked out of screenings of it. Men have jumped literally 3 feet backwards and been so
frightened
out and wouldn't talk to me. And they're like, I dated you. I dated an actress like you. And I have to try to convince them that I'm really nice and normal. But Irene in Time is a completely different character about a girl whose father died when she was 13. And so she's just trying to sort of replace daddy with the right man. And she's having trouble, as many women do, finding the right guy who is like her father. I think a lot of women essentially look for their fathers and their mates, you know, whether they're conscious of it or not. And so it kind of deals with those complicated issues.
Yeah.
And then we're filming I'm really excited to film the sequel to Queen of the Lot, where Margie's made three big comedies, but she's trying to be a dramatic actress, but she just can't help but be funny, and so nobody takes her seriously, and she's Noah Wiley is going to be the new heartthrob in it, as sort of a reporter, undercover reporter who's writing a tell-all book on her life. And she, you know, the movie starts out with her in an ankle bracelet because she's had three DUIs, and so it's going to be fun. It's more exploration of the dark secrets of Hollywood and the you know, the addictions and all of that good stuff.
You know, something strikes me as you're talking about these characters, and that's that I want your take on this. Obviously, you're very fortunate with Jaglom in that he seems to know how to write for women.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to still be some kind of disparity here, because even Jerry and I were speaking on the show last week. We're looking ahead at award season, we're looking ahead at what we consider that might be the Oscar-worthy performances, and it seems to be so uneven. I mean, I could look at the obvious male performers, the Mickey Rourkes and Sean Penns, that, you know, I think have a good shot, but I'm harder pressed to find the female performances, just because they don't seem to write those kinds of roles for women. Do you still find that true?
That's a good point. Gosh, I've heard, you know, I read so many interviews about women complaining about how there aren't any roles for women and there aren't any good scripts. My take or my experience has been that there are amazing roles for women, and I think that it just comes out of fear or a lack of vision of
mm-hmm.
when people read the scripts, not seeing that this role could be great or what they could do with it. I think that it's the actress's responsibility to come up with the ingenuity to figure out how to make the role great and how to make it different and how to collaborate with the director. I think film right now is really compartmentalized, in that there's not enough, I mean, except for, you know, Woody Allen films, or, you know, once Altman films. There's just not enough of artistic collaboration, and I think there's not enough of women really standing up and giving their voice to a role. I mean, I've honestly come across great scripts, and when I haven't come across great scripts, I've researched, I've looked for the scripts, and it doesn't take that long to find great roles for women. I think it's just a matter of, I don't know, of women finding them and standing up and being bold and brave enough to embrace a role that people may not like. I mean, I got great reviews, and some people thought I was really annoying as this character, you know. And it's just a matter of being okay with not being liked. And I think that there are a lot more women who have problems with that than men. You know, women are taught, I think, from an earlier age to be good girls and to be liked and be polite and make people happy. And I think that's just, I don't know. That's a theory that I've never expounded on, but
no,
there
that's
you
a
go.
Good point.
No, that's a very good point.
That's a good point.
Very good.
Tana, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we welcome you back on the show anytime in the future when you want to come on. You're delightful.
Thank you so much for having me, and I will send you movies, so if you want to...
All right,
if you want to pass them out to any of the audience,
we'd love to.
Just back up the truck. thank you so much, Tana, very much.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That's Tana Frederick. Her new films are called Hollywood Dreams and Irene in Time. Hollywood Dreams available on DVD, Irene in Time, opening in theaters December 12th, both collaborations with legendary director Henry Jaglom. She was very nice.
She was.
Very, very, very nice guest. And I have been, I know you have too, Jerry, and all of our listeners too. This is the moment we've been waiting for. We're very excited about our next guest here. And he just picked up an Emmy last night. He's fresh off an Emmy win.
This is awesome.
We've got an Emmy winner, my friend.
We got an Emmy winner. I mean, this is just incredible. I mean,
we're serious here.
This keeps getting better.
He's producing extraordinary work, and his latest work is incredible. It's my favorite score of the year. Composer Month continues tonight with Jeff Beal, an extraordinary musician and film composer whose works include the television series Rome, Carnival, Ugly Betty, and Monk, the miniseries Nightmares and Dreamscapes, and The Company, which is what he just won his Emmy for last night, as well as a roster of films including Hide and Seek, The Deal, Pollock, and Al Pacino's latest directorial effort, Salamaybe. And as crazed as I am about Al Pacino, don't think for a second I'm not going to ask about that. His latest work accompanies Ed Harris's gritty Western, Appaloosa, and Ed Harris himself praised Jeff for his intelligence, humanity, fearlessness, and his uncanny ability to hear the sounds that drama depends on, oozing out of every pore. And that's high praise indeed and very well deserved. It's a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show composer Mr. Jeff Beal. Mr. Beal, hello.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for having me, Jamie. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. I'm so glad we could overcome last week's.
Yeah, well, it was good timing because you know I was glad I won last night because I told you I was going to the Emmys, so we were going to have to talk about losing. So talking about winning is so much more fun, you know.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about winning. Tell me how exciting that ceremony must have been.
It was great, and the Emmys for years have been held in the Shrine, and we moved to the Nokia Theater, which is a brand new theater near the Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles, and it was just a fantastic night. We are sort of the low-rent Emmys, you know, the real Emmys with all the movie stars happens next weekend. This was called the Creative Arts Ceremonies, but it was for all the music, editing, cinematography, and other crafts that make up the TV Academy. So I've won and lost. It was funny, the first time I ever won, I won, so that was my only experience. And then I had a string of losses, so I kind of know what both feel like now, so... I was very surprised and really glad. It's a miniseries that Ridley Scott produced, which was just wonderful, and the director, Mikhail Solomon. It's a spy story, and it's sort of got this really great paranoid and fearful 50s feeling to it, and he just shot it beautifully, and it was a really wonderful project to compose for.
Oh, I bet it was. Now, is this your fourth Emmy win? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, I have the three primetime Emmys and one news and documentary Emmy. So there's four. So I think I might, it might be time to invest in some sort of, you know, they're sitting on a shelf in the kitchen in my studio. I think, you know, I'm like, either it's going to be eBay or a nice home for him now. Cause
you need a very nice trophy case, my friend.
Yeah, so you know, and you know these awards, you know, listen, but they're great. It's the great sort of stamp of approval, and sort of puts people at ease when they come over to work with you and see those,
yeah,
you know, those statues there. It's kind of like, okay, and it is a great honor. I mean, it's the music branch is fantastic. You know, after Pollack, of course, I was hoping that it was going to launch this great feature film career, and more, much to my surprise, but to my gratification, it launched more. I mean, I've done quite a few independent, great, wonderful, smaller movies, but I got into this sort of great TV world of doing these HBO series like Carnival and like Rome, and some really wonderful cable and now network series with Ugly Betty and Monk. So it's been quite an interesting ride, and I think the quality of music done on TV and the quality of everybody doing TV now is just enormous, and I think it's sort of indicative of the way people can kind of watch things at home now with their high-def TVs and surround sound. It's nice to see those lines between the two mediums, I think, sort of blurring.
Yeah, and I think that TV, a good portion of it, as of late, has really attempted to be more of a cinematic experience.
Definitely.
Yeah, do you find that that's why the need and the use of music score is so prominent in TV today?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it started early on with HBO. They kind of raised the bar. But you know, as acting talent, like you were talking with your last guest, especially for females, as roles sort of to dry up in the feature world, you know, you had actresses like Sierra Kedwick and
Holly Hunter yeah,
cross over and create these great characters on TV. You got a young actor like America Ferrera who does both. You know, HBO is easy just because there's no commercials and it's very, you know, they just kind of have the budgets, and their concept has always been to make things, at least the series I did for them, they have a real cinematic quality to them. But you look at even a network show like Lost or 24, or you know, or on the lighter side, Ugly Betty, which I do, which, you know, I'll put that up against almost any romantic comedy feature film out there, and I'd say the production value of that is right on par, and certainly the acting, the cast and the performances are right up there as well.
Well, Jerry and I have maintained that the best writing, consistent best writing, comes from TV now, which is very refreshing. Yeah. Let me talk a little bit about your background. Now, you came from a musical family, didn't you? Did they really nurture your pursuit of music?
They did, yeah. And the most musical member, I would say, was probably, you know, everybody sort of played and enjoyed music as amateurs. My father is still, you know, he's singing in barbershop quartets, and my mom is has been a piano player for her whole life and played flute. My father's mother, my grandmother, was a real eclectic artist, and she actually, I only learned this a few years ago, but she actually played piano for silent movies in a silent movie theater in Boise, Idaho, like way back in the 20s, you know. And that was a thrill to hear, because, you know, when you look at the way a modern film composer works, it's so close to the way what we do. And she was also a huge jazz fan. When I started playing trumpet at an early age, she actually gave me my first Miles Davis albums, you know.
Sketches
very
of Spain.
Hip grandmother, you know.
Yeah. Sketches of Spain, I hear, was a particular
Yes. influence. I wore that thing out, man. It blew my mind, rocked my world in every sort of way,
mm-hmm.
both Miles and Gil Evans.
Yeah.
You know, what an
amazing
thing, you know.
Amazing music. Now your instrument of choice at this time was the trumpet, correct?
Yeah.
Now, Terrence Blanchard told us that he chose the trumpet because it sounded like the human voice to him. And so I'm wondering what drew you to that instrument.
Yeah, I don't think I was that sophisticated as a young kid. I think I was your typical, gosh, I think I was third grade sitting in an assembly with my dad, and they played that instrument. And, you know, when you're a boy at that age, that's just like the most ballsy instrument, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and it's very extroverted, and I love the sound of it. And it's funny because as I sort of matured as a musician and I married a wonderful singer, she's an opera singer and does many other things, you know, as my taste in jazz sort of progressed, I sort of gravitated more towards Chet Baker and Miles Davis and the more vocal style of playing. So I kind of made a bit of an evolution in what I loved about the instrument, I think, from the very first beginnings. But it's kind of ironic, you know, you think back to the decisions you make as such a young person and how they might influence, you know, your whole path creatively.
Yeah. And so where did film composition come in? When did you start considering it?
Yeah, I was always fascinated by it. I grew up in the 1970s, you know, so this was the age of some really amazing music on TV, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, you know, the great blockbusters of the 70s, still the George Lucas and Steven Spielberg blockbusters. Coppola was doing Apocalypse Now, and there was The Deer Hunter, and I was really fascinated with film music. But I was also sort of, I had my musical interest in a lot of areas, one of them really being a trumpet performer, like Terrence, who now still does it much more regularly than I do. But I went to Eastman School of Music. I studied classical trumpet there, but I was also sort of a double major in jazz composition, and they had a film scoring program. That's one of the reasons I went there. So it's, you know, you look back on your life and it all sort of makes sense, but there was a progression, I would say, in my earlier professional years where I sort of moved away from performing, and as the composition assignments got more interesting and more fulfilling, that sort of took over. And I realize now that I was sort of always born to be a composer. I mean, that's really who I am, you know. And but I love the fact that part of being a composer I'm still a music maker. You know, I play in a lot of my scores. Even when I did like Rome for HBO, I ended up, you know, playing a lot of other instruments that I'd never even tried before, which was really thrilling and fun and experimental. And so it's an evolution, I guess. And I don't know what I'll be doing, you know, in 10 years from now, but right now this feels like I feel very at home at it. I also like the fact that I think being a film composer, you're free of the tyranny of, you kind of get out, you're able to get outside of yourself, because each project is sort of its own little world that you escape into. Whereas if you're a solo artist, it's more about cultivating a personality and a sound. It's always sort of comes back to reflect on you a little more directly. And I've always loved the more collaborative sort of place to do what I do. You know, I like that interaction I have with the other elements.
What fascinates me, and we've spoken about this to the other composers we've had on as of late, you mentioned some great films from the 70s that were of particular influence to you. And being a composer is like every position on the film set. It's being an assistant storyteller in a way, I would think. So what about your film education in terms of reading a film, for lack of a better phrase?
Mm-hmm.
That's important, isn't it, for a composer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I think when I was learning music, you know, there's a certain amount of literacy that you attain as a musician, you know, in whatever specialties you're pursuing. For me, it was really the classical literature of the classical composers, and it was jazz, because those were my two original passions. And in the same way, I think as I've worked in film, I've wanted, and I'm still working, trying to attain, you know, a level of literacy about filmmaking, because it's all about that. It's what you do is only valuable in the sense that it contributes to the whole, but it's so mysterious to me. There's this odd synergy which happens or doesn't happen when the right piece of music sort of becomes a part of a scene, and, you know, maybe it's what you expect or maybe it isn't what you expected, or it surprises you in some cool sort of way.
Yeah.
And the sum becomes, you know, the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts, as they say, and that's what we all strive for. I don't know if I'm answering your question. It's fascinating to talk a long time about this, but story and the thing I love about film, and for example, Ed's movie is a great example because there's such great acting in it. Film is a visual medium, and a lot of times what's not being said is as interesting or more interesting as what's being said. You know, so when you talk about writing, when you talk about storytelling, of course there's a script and the story, and those are all important elements, but there's this strange thing that happens. Even if you read a script, you really don't know what the movie is until you see it as well, and you see how what an actor's doing in a scene and the tempo of their dialogue and all these little subtleties that everybody brings to it. It becomes a living thing and a breathing thing, and it's, I guess it's kind of like trying to suss out all those nonverbal things that are going on. That's a really the challenge of a composer, and it's kind of sly what you try to do, what you try to accomplish, because you want to get. I love when I go to a movie. I love a movie I get lost in. That's the experience I want to have.
That's right. Yeah.
And as a composer, you know, that's always, I guess, the goal, the bar I'm setting for myself is to make something that feels so compelling and believable that an audience can just suspend all disbelief and just kind of go there with the actors and whatever, and all these elements, sort of enjoy it.
Sure.
It's really like a modern day church. I mean, you know, psychologists, you know, have talked about this. You know, Jungians have talked about, you know, film is really sort of like our modern day Greek theater or religious communal experience we have. It's really the only common cultural experience I think we all have. It used to be with music, there would be a new album out and you could discuss an artist. Oh, did you get the new blah 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 CD? It's not really like that anymore. But film still is this sort of one common communal experience that we all have, that we share.
We do have that, and that's I think the home entertainment craze is wonderful in so many respects, but that's the one part that scares me about it, is that it doesn't play so much as a communal experience, which I think is so valuable about film. Let's talk about Ed Harris.
Absolutely.
I don't know if this is true, but I read that he had terminated two composers by the time he hired you on for Pollock, and I was wondering what was he looking for that he didn't seem to be getting from at that point.
That is true, and actually, somebody was working on this movie before I came on board, so it tends to be a bit of a pattern with him as an artist. I think that music is weird. It is. As he said, even to me when we were working on it, you know, it's kind of like I'll know it when I hear it. But he sets his bar so high in every area that he's very specific, he's very artistic, and I've been lucky in each of these movies in the sense that he's been down the path with other folks before he comes to me, because of course you learn each failure, you learn. And of course we had our failures too in working on both those movies, you know, things that we tried and we moved away from. So in the case of Pollock, it's an example, I think, of what we were talking about earlier, in the sense that here you have a story of a manic depressive artist who kills himself at the end of the movie as alcoholic, right? A real,
yes.
So that's one arc, but the other arc is this amazing journey of this brilliant man who invented something. And I think he realized in the other attempts that there was nothing to root for or celebrate. And he realized when he came to me and listened to some of my music that he needed to find a voice in the music for the soul of the art of this man and celebrate that and make it as an amazingly sort of dramatic and engaging as it was on film. I mean, those painting sequences in Pollock are just incredible sequences.
Yeah.
They're some of the still my favorite scenes that I've ever worked on in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think that's kind of where he was with the film when I came on board. So that's what we tried to do with the score, and you know, luckily for both of us, it worked out.
It really did.
The other thing I'd say to his credit, it's funny because he's also very sure of himself. He has, when he hears something, I mean, it's funny, when he called me to work on Pollock, I was recommended to him by Mark Isham, a dear friend, fellow jazz trumpet player.
We've spoken to Mark, too,
yeah.
And he was incredible.
Cool.
Yes.
Great guy, you know, very talented. He's done some amazing work for many years. And he recommended me to Ed, and I had sent a CD over, and I heard other composers were involved, and so I kind of had forgotten about it. And then finally I get a call from my agent, you know, Ed Harris wants to speak to you. And I get on the phone with him, and he's the most un-Hollywood person you'd ever deal with. And he says, oh, Jeff, this is Ed Harris. I've lost your list of credits. And I'm thinking, oh, great, because, you know, you probably wouldn't even be on the phone with me. But he said, I've got the CD of yours, and I really like your music.
Yeah.
And there was something he heard and who I was as an artist that he responded to. And that was gold. I mean, because that's what you're always hoping for in a young composer, is that somebody will just take the time to listen to what you do and see it. Because until you have those credit cards to the Emmys or whatever to sort of give people confidence, it's got to be your work that gets over with them.
I wholeheartedly agree, and I think your music is a major part of it. Those scenes in Pollock are my favorite as well, when he's actually in the process, because more than any other film I can think of, it really puts you inside that process and how that art is an extension of him.
Yeah.
You just felt that. It was a tangible thing in that film that you got the sense of.
Yeah.
And you are very, Pollock is definitely a very inventive score, and as is your themes for Appaloosa. And, obviously I think we talk to a lot of composers that say that their dream genre is a Western because it's such an iconic kind of field. And you have in your mind what constitutes a typical Western score.
Yeah.
But you go outside the box quite a bit in this score.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not extremely musical, but I thought I heard definitely a trumpet. I think I heard a tuba. How did you want to make this one unique? What was that process like?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say I was dreaming of doing a Western. I think when I knew it was a Western and I finally got the job, I was more kind of terrified because of this amazing work. I mean, look at Ennio Morricone and Elmer Bernstein. This amazing stuff that had been created. But it was nice because it was also coming on the heels of last year's movies, which were starting to revive the genre, like, 3:10 to Yuma and The Assassination of Jesse James, and to an extent even There Will Be Blood. They weren't Westerns through and through, but they were historic movies all sort of in a general time period. And
Beltrami's score for Pretend to Yuma is another
great
example.
Score.
Absolutely great score. And there was I would say that the tone of this movie, when I looked at it as a film, it was somewhere in between that and the other two movies I mentioned. Maybe The Assassination of Jesse James would be the counterbalancing.
Right.
That was more of an interior, character-based, quirkier
existential
take on
almost.
Pardon?
Existential almost.
Yeah. Although, the thing that's interesting about this movie for Ed is he would never use the word existential, because one of the things he told me early on is, like, there's no psychology going on here. These people just do what they do.
It's a straight... Well, he said he was very straightforward, was the impression I got from an interview
I
read a couple of weeks ago. He said, this is not, he did say...
Revisionist,
it's not like, it's not the Assassination of Jesse James. This is this is very straight, almost, I want to say old school almost.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it was. He wanted to really evoke the sort of elegance and simplicity, I think, of the classic Western. And I think he really accomplished that. It was very fun in trying to find a musical voice for it, because we didn't want to just ape the tone of whatever that music was.
Mm-hmm.
But we did want to invoke the spirit of that kind of simplicity. There was a sense that he had with these characters, and it was the only thing I can think of as similar in my own past work was the music I did for Rome for HBO, in the sense that you're revisiting history, you're meeting people, but you're meeting them on at ground level. You're not looking down with some big filtered romantic lens. You're not putting a huge mythic spin on it.
Right.
It's more, but. So as a composer, you sit there and you think, well, what the hell do I do then? That's what music does. Music makes things bigger, and so it was a bit of a search. But I think that we found some of the fun things we found were, of course, there was this amazing story. It's really a story of a friendship. It's Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen, who play these great guys who don't say a lot, but they know each other well. It's all about this sort of weird world of male relationships, friendships, and the loyalty and the history that guys like this have who just go from town to town,
Sounds like
Westerns are uniquely positioned to explore those male relationships.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the Wild Bunch, relationship between the leads there.
Exactly.
And Bill Holden.
Yeah. It had that kind of, and I know that's what drew Ed to it. Ed never wanted to make a Western per se, but he just started reading the book, and he loved these characters. So that's really kind of where we went in. And, you know, there was some, I put the score on just to kind of refresh my brain to try to think of something smart to say with you guys. And there's some hints of some jazzy stuff and some bluesy stuff. And it's almost like these guys are kind of cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of rhythm, because one of the things Ed told me was, like, you know, these people are always moving. Once something happens, it's like, okay, what do I do next, you know?
Right.
So there's always the sense that things are moving forward, that there's no time to sit back and sort of relish, you know, a moment in the West. It's all about survival. And that plays into Renee Zellweger's character, too, because she kind of blows into town, and she's got a dollar in a pocket, and she plays the piano, and she ends up sort of being a wedge between these two central characters. And so the music for her didn't want to color that world and make her, like, evil or a sexual predator,
mm-hmm.
but she was just a woman, you know, this kind of quirky woman plunked down in the middle of this town of nowhere who was going to try to survive, you know. So I'm dancing around it a little bit, but I think you're getting a sense of, like, what we were up against and trying to do and create. But on the other end, there are some really great suspense and some action moments where we were able to sort of go into that sort of, you know, 310 to Yuma, real dramatic, fun, you know. It's a popcorn movie. It's in one sense, it's a popcorn movie for grown-ups, you know. There's some great action sequences, some great suspense, and those kind of things as well.
All right, we've talked about it enough. Let's go ahead and see what we're talking about. Hear what we're talking about
here. Let's hear it. Yeah, let's do it.
I'm telling you, I'm crazy about this score. Here's the first track. This is the main title theme, I believe.
Yeah.
For Appaloosa. Here it is, this extraordinary work. Here it is. Is that not the greatest, Jerry?
That's awesome.
I wish
this was playing right now so I could go see it.
Yeah.
I really do want to see this. It looks incredible.
It's really a fun movie, and you got to see it on the big screen. You know, one of the things about Ed's directing is that it's like his acting, you know. You got to pay attention and get into it. And I remember when I worked on Pollock, we didn't have a lot of screenings, you know, previews. So I was mostly looking on my video monitor in my studio, and I went to the multiplex to see it when it was out in theaters, and I feel like I'd finally seen it at the movie because and this is very similar. He doesn't do a lot of camera tricks. He shoots pretty wide. It's all about just sitting there, and you see it, and I've seen it. We had a preview in high HD before I scored it, and I sat and watched it. After having watched it on DVD, it was like, wow. you know, so I encourage people to go out to the theaters. And I'd also say that, you know, I'm a father. My son is 13, and it's got an R rating, and I'm kind of surprised because there's really nothing worse than a PG-13 in terms of language. I mean, yeah, language or nudity or violence. So if you have some kind of some older teens or younger teens mm-hmm. who you think might enjoy a Western that's not going to, you know, make you cringe that your kids are with you, I'd say bring them because it's a really fun movie.
Yeah. Does it open – I'm sorry, does it open this Wednesday or this Friday?
I believe it's this Friday in New York and L.A., and then it opens wide on October 3rd, rest of the country. So.
Oh, cool, my birthday. Awesome.
Perfect.
That's your birthday present.
Yeah, there
you go.
Go
cool. See a Western, man.
Ed Harris made a birthday present just for you.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm really shocked. I mean, but it's cool.
Yeah. I have two more questions for you, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this one right here. Everyone associated with the show knows that Pacino is my creative idol.
I would never have known
great.
That.
I would. Well, we'll have to do it again and just talk about this. And I don't know if that's being sarcastic or not.
No, I am not.
Dude,
he is
dead serious.
Oh, good. I'm so
glad. If you walk away with nothing else from this show, walk away with that one important fact.
Okay, good.
I have been trying, begging to get him on the show for the longest time. Just give me a sense, just like a minute or so, how exciting that experience was and what that collaboration meant to you.
Really amazing. In fact, we're still doing it. The movie's a very long. Al takes a long time to finish his movies.
Yeah.
I think Looking for Richard, he worked on for about 3 years, and this one he's about a year and a half into. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be done by now, and I've written a lot of the score. I'm kind of taking a break while they're still cutting, experimenting. But I got to tell you guys, this is one of the great artists of our time, and I'm not trying to. I don't use those words lightly, but you know, his output is not as prolific as some actors. But when you spend some time with this guy and you're around what he's doing and see what he's striving for, I just have an enormous respect and love for what he does. And you know, I know his earlier performances, but you know, I also watched him in Angels in America a few years ago and was again just transformed by the brilliance of this man. And
yeah, he's superb in that.
He's really amazing. But it takes a while. Like most people like Al, okay, it takes a while till he feels comfortable and safe with you. And it was really kind of a funny process getting the job because unlike most directors, you'd sort of like have a meeting and then they'd hire you or not. But with Al, it was like I needed to go to a bunch of preview screenings and sort of just hang out with him, you know, and we'd go and talk afterwards. And after I felt comfortable, I'd start to sort of pitch out some of my ideas about the film and what I thought we should do. And basically, as we got more and more comfortable and the trust evolved, of course, our creative relationship got even better. One of the things I love about working with him, it was after I'd written a few things early on, which he was luckily he really enjoyed. I mean, they were kind of an audition. I don't think anybody called it that, but they were kind of like that. Mm. And we went to a screening at CAA with those cues in it, and he came to me afterwards, and he was very complimentary. And he said, oh, by the way, because it's like most movies, there's quite a bit of temp music in it. He goes, you know, that temp stuff is fine, but he looked me straight in the eye, and he goes, listen, I just want you to do your thing.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you, I mean, I can count on like one hand, you know, the number of directors that have ever really just challenged. I mean, Ed Harris is another person like that who's never looked at me and said, can you copy that? You know, that's all we need. Don't just do that and we're fine, you know. And not that all directors are that lazy or have that lack of vision, but it was something beyond that. You know what it is? It's something every great actor has. It's understanding and trusting that place we all try to go as artists where, you know, you sort of, it's the dance with the universe, with the muse, where you just sort of surrender all control, all your past work, all of your preconceptions, and you actually allow yourself to risk something and just lose yourself. And that's what he loves, you know?
Yeah.
And he's passionate about it. This is a really cool film. It's basically a documentary about his love affair with Oscar Wilde's play Salome, and it takes all sorts of twists and turns. But it's a really amazing film. And when it's all done, maybe we can call again and chat about that.
I would love to.
We did
a tribute to Pacino last year. We got to speak with five cast members of Salome, so we're on top of this
wonderful
film. So just tell them we said hello.
I will, absolutely.
Yeah.
I just have one more question. It's my James Lipton question, so get ready for it. What has music given you, and what have you given music?
Boy, I feel much more greedy than I feel like I've taken so much more than I've given. I don't need a therapist. It's my therapy. It's my meditation. It's my prayer. It's my way to sort of tap into the universe. It's my healing. I was diagnosed with MS last year, which really kind of sucks, but I have a newfound love for what I do, because I realize that what I do is part of that, you know, part of embracing the world and the universe. And I haven't given it to myself. It's a gift you give away. So I feel very fortunate. You know, people write to me. I have a website. And I get notes, and I try to read them. I try to respond to them. But I hope I've given people a little bit of joy, a little bit of escape from the mundane. You know, which is why what we try to do as artists. You know, a little bit of glimpse into something that's maybe beyond the mundane and beyond our petty world that we normally find ourselves in.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, music is the universal language, so that's
absolutely. Yeah.
I thank you so much for your work. It brings me a tremendous amount of joy, and thank you so much, my friend, for joining us tonight and sharing time with us.
Thank you both. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Veal. Have a good
night. And have a good birthday and enjoy that movie.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jeff Beal, great. Just great. I was really looking forward to that. Not just to ask about Pacino, but
no, we know. No, dude. We've had a stellar night. You could not ask for a better night tonight. So we've had an awesome show so far.
Let's just pay a little bit of attention just for a couple of minutes to the two new movies, which you've seen both and I've seen one. The one that we've actually both seen is Righteous Kill, speaking of Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
Pacino and De Niro's pairing for the first time, they're all the way through the film together. Do you and I both agree that that's the only reason to see the movie, really?
I think so. I think that's, I mean, I don't think, let's put it like this, if it was two other actors or it was something straight to I think this would be a straight to DVD movie if these two weren't in it.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. You know, and Pacino's talked about this, and maybe De Niro feels the same way. He likes to quote Paul Newman when Paul Newman said, if I waited for the things that I really wanted to do, I wouldn't make a movie but every 5 years, and sometimes I just want to work. And I you know, it's unfortunate that the script is the problem, surprisingly enough, coming from the writer of Inside Man.
What I couldn't get over watching it is that, and I'm not saying, I mean, there's blame to go around, but you start with the script, and you're like thinking, this is the same guy who wrote Inside Man.
Yeah.
And you don't see any of those flourishes, any of those great plot devices from Inside Man, and this seems... You know, it's not, I want to say this right now, this is not the worst movie ever made, and it's not, obviously, I don't think, I'm not going to say it's a great movie, but it is, unfortunately, run-of-the-mill. And
it's subpar, yeah.
We don't associate, this is the problem I think we're, at least that I'm having, I'm just speaking for myself when I say this, is that you don't, at least growing up, and especially in the 80s and the 90s when I was, you know, really in touch with these two actors' works, it never dawned on me that they would be in a movie like this. It just doesn't come across the radar ever, because they're such masters of their craft. And reality does set in with this.
I do
and
think
it's hard.
I do, yeah, and maybe it's indicative of their age group. There aren't any really stellar roles. The stellar roles are few and far between. They're 5 years apart, as Pacino
Mm-hmm.
express, and I can see why Pacino wanted to do it. I mean, because he likes John Avnet, and you know, people say this should have had a different director, but anyone could have directed this movie from this script, and it would have been what it is.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
would need to retool it, or just get another, draft, or just start from scratch.
It is lacking a moral depth that I so badly wanted from
mm-hmm.
it's a little shallow that's I think the equivalent of the Law and Order reference that the critics always throw out. You know, you can almost program in the commercial breaks in this film.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It does. I know a lot of people love Law and Order. I wish it wasn't on my parents' house all the time, but it is. I mean, I think there should be a Law and Order channel just devoted to Law and Order.
There's too much programming for one channel.
Yeah, but it does. It felt like that. It did feel like. I kept waiting for Chris Noth to come in or Eric Ogazi to show up. I guess they're the latest cast members on it, you know, like waiting for them to show up.
I think Abnett's a good director. I think maybe he's facing the same dilemma that Pacino and De Niro are facing, even though, in all fairness, I think Pacino's had better luck with great roles as of late.
We talked about that earlier.
Yeah. But this is the Abnett that, you know, copycat Fried Green Tomatoes, the BBC singing detective. I mean, he's proven himself, and actors like him. I think he's a good director who doesn't go with very good material, the same way that people say of Pacino and De Niro as of late.
But I think you brought up a good point. If it does come from Paul or whoever said that, and I think Pacino is probably thinking of that because he did go through a period where he did not make a lot. So he.
Yeah.
And I think it's something we've talked about other when we joke about Samuel Jackson. I think there is a thing psychologically that if they don't take this script, they might never, you know, there's a fear that, hey, I might not, when's the next script going to come? You know,
yeah,
if they don't
yeah.
take it. You want to take what's offered to you, and you try to make the most of it. I know that sounds like we're being apologists, but we're not. We're just stating the reality of acting.
That being said, it is a riveting movie to see the two of them interact together. And there definitely is an ease there that wouldn't have existed with complete strangers, I don't find. It's worth watching just for that. I mean, if you're inclined, if you're so inclined like we were, like, I have to see them together no matter the quality of the movie, then, you know, pay attention to them. You won't
be disappointed. Let me say this, this will maybe answer a lot of questions. There's a certain sense with some actors, and Pacino and De Niro definitely fall in this category, and there are others. I will, regardless of the reviews, I will go see the films. I think the only De Niro film I stayed away from completely, never saw, was the Rocky and Bullwinkle one, because that I just couldn't bring. I don't care how much. I was not paid money. It was a free screening. I just could not bring myself.
Well, the movie, in all
that.
Honesty, wasn't made for you either.
I don't know. Some would say never. I can't. I'm not going to say that right now. We'll get all the Sarah Palin fans upset. But it is hard though, because let me use another actor actually, and then we can go on to something else. They're in the 90s, the mid 90s. Chow Yun-fat came into this country, you know, to make the American films. He was, you know, made all these wonderful films overseas, a lot of great action films. His American debut is really, I have to say, a wretched, disappointing film, The Replacement Killers.
Right.
I was expecting something, you know, like what he would do for John Woo or Ringo Lam. And I'll be very honest with you, it just felt like I was watching the equivalent of a Van Damme movie.
So are you saying that Pacino and De Niro made better movies in Hong Kong?
Well, no, but I see there's this thing, well, they did awesome work in Hong Kong. I mean, but, you know, it's like that. I will, you know, there's a devotion to a lot of actors, and when they, especially for the ones from overseas, and they make their big American debut, and especially with the Asian actors, sadly, who are pigeonholed with the action films, and they do so much more in their native countries than just action. But with De Niro and Pacino, it's just, I'm going to continue to go see every movie they're in.
Let's talk about the movies that they're in. Pacino's next movie, he was playing Salvador Dali for Andrew Niccol. And De Niro, one of his next movies is a gangster film called Frankie Machine that he's mm-hmm. doing for Michael Mann. I mean, talk about Michael Mann. Speaking of a writer,
mm-hmm.
director, who knows how to bring the most out of these actors. Some of their most vital work have been under his writing and directing. And I think that's what they need to focus on. I think they need to focus on finding better material. But it's hard. I mean, they can't, you know, Pacino has other outlets. He can do his own film. He can do theater.
Yeah, and
but
I think
if you depend on the industry to give you another Dog Day Afternoon, It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, and the only place I think it's going to really happen is on the independent side.
Right.
And I don't know what the dynamics of that. I don't know what you would have to actually. I would think that would be Pacino actually, you know, really scouring the landscape to see who's out there, who he'd want to work with. Does he want to go that route? It's very interesting that our last guest brought up that, you know, Salamaby's taking longer than it would, and he does like to take his time. The local stigmatic was took a long time for us to see.
Right.
So.
Yeah, he said kind of these are passion projects for him,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
he's invested. And, you know, he still, you know, I just got done talking about Pacino being my idol, and he is.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. There's always stuff to relish in every performance he gives for me. But it just is indicative of the caliber of writing that is available even for our legends out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It's barely there.
But,
Burn After Reading is something that you've seen that I have not yet.
I liked it a lot. Now, the Futurist hated it. He's in the chat room, and he hated it. And the reasons he gathers for hating it, I can understand. I can see that in there. I understand what he's talking about. But I had to say, I actually really enjoyed it. I did not think I would because I've heard, you know, there are mixed things going in I had heard. But I was really surprised how I really got into it. It actually offered a lot more because everyone says this is like, you know, you read some of the reviews and it's just like, oh, it's such a disappointment. Like an our city paper on the Washington Post hated it. I mean, gave it a really nasty review. I have to say, dude, I was really, really got into the film. All the actors, but you know who is incredible in this film? Malkovich.
Really? Yeah.
He was tailor-made to work with these guys.
Yeah.
It complements his personality so much. The Osborne Cox character that he plays, which is like sort of like a parody of Matt Damon in The Good Shepherd almost. Just wonderful. It's a wonderful film, and I think I would put it somewhere in between, like as far as their comedies or as any dark comedy, somewhere in between No Country for Old Men and The Big Lebowski. I don't think it's better than either one of those movies, but it stays with you a lot longer than you think it would. There are some very interesting things going on.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That's what I hear, that it's it feels it's a fun ride, but there is something under the lunacy that
there
that is uniquely theirs.
Mm-hmm. No one else could do this.
It's very, you know, it's par for the course. I knew the second that they announced the project, and this is typical of them, that it wouldn't be as well received as it should be, because they did the same thing with Lebowski. You know,
mm-hmm.
they did Fargo, and everybody's like, oh, serious filmmakers, oh, they're great, and then they have fun with Big Lebowski, and everyone's
right.
so disappointed. Oh, they behave like it's shallow. It's a different animal, and can anyone deny now the influence of the Big Lebowski, you know?
It's. I mean, we did a whole show on it. You know, it's the stature, the cult status, but even beyond the cult status, it's the film. Every time I watch it, I see something new.
Mm.
I think the ending, you know, people have a lot of problems, and a lot of people have a problem with the ending of Burn After Reading, and especially, you know, Country for Old Men. I think their endings, there's something melancholy about them, but I think they're beautiful. There's something very beautiful. I think the ending of No Country for Old Men, where he talks about the dream. That
haunting.
It is. And that took on, for me this summer, that took on a whole new meaning. But this, the ending of this, I like it. I like how it's handled. I was thinking about it afterwards. I'm like, you know what? That really works very well.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah,
I know everything. I know everything about it. You know what? I'm such a moron. But it doesn't ruin it for me, though. I knew the ending of Righteous Kill before I walked in. So I was watching it in a point of view where, having known the ending, I was thinking maybe I can, you know, look for the little telltale, you know, where a mystery like that.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch it a second time, you have a different focus.
Right.
But there was nothing really to focus on, and the climax of Righteous Kill, it wasn't so much what happened, but the manner in which it was portrayed that
right.
I was very disappointed in. And that's really where it's missing that moral conflict. It doesn't have it. It pays lip service to it, but you don't feel it.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Bird After Reading, I can't wait to see that.
No, but I will say this about Righteous Kill. It was it was good to see, even though they didn't really give him much to do, it was nice to see Brian Denny in a movie. I haven't seen him in a while. And, you know, when we did our show on character actors, you know, I forgot to mention him, but he's one of those great character actors that
we have. He is phenomenal. And also, there's something we said that people have been mentioning. Denny has a 70-year-old lieutenant, and Pacino is a 68-year-old, and De Niro is a 65-year-old. I mean, Pacino still looks great to me.
Yeah.
This is I am a straight male. Let me say that. Not that there's, you know, not that I should make that distinction, but I find Pacino like, you know what it is? I want to be Pacino.
Because well, I mean, if you're gonna pick someone to be, I mean, that's, you know.
He is my Steve McQueen, actually, getting back to the first segment. I want to be that cool. All right, let's end the show real quick. Let's bring on Aaron. Aaron's show back by midnight. They have a special lineup on Tuesday, I believe. Hey, Aaron, what's going on?
Hey, what's up, fellas?
Hey, what's up?
What's up, baby?
Hey, how you all doing?
How are you doing there in Texas?
Oh, we're fine. San Antonio, where I'm at. Nothing really going on. It's a little windy, but you know, even then it wasn't like massive windy, so...
That was my first girlfriend, Little Wendy, I remember. She was wonderful.
But you're not feeling the effects of, the storm where you were.
No effects. The only thing that happened is that a lot of the evacuation from Houston that happened earlier in the week, elderly and from the hospitals, a lot of them were brought down here.
So, right.
But, I mean, nothing major. And even from what I hear, I go, I mean, yes, like 2,000 people had to be saved. But even then, from what I'm hearing, it could have been a lot worse.
That's what I read this morning. But it's still the damage to Galveston was...
Well, yeah, for pretty much Galveston is non-existent right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of sad. But as for...
That is, yeah.
How's your brother's...
They're fine. They're here. Okay. So from what we understand, don't know if power has been restored. But, like, the tallest building in downtown Houston, the top 30 floors, like, all the windows got blown out on one side.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah.
Saw a live picture of downtown on some of the roads, and it's just basically the roads are now glass. I mean, so got to clean all that up. But,
for those of you just joining us, you're tuning into the Weather Channel podcast on Blog Talk Radio.
It could have been a lot worse, but so...
I'm glad you're okay. As long as you're okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. You have a special show on Tuesday.
Thursday. Let me correct
you. Thursday. I'm sorry, man. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us all about it.
On September 18th, Thursday, at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific, for everyone, we'll be having a tribute show, a special show dedicated to the first three films written and directed by John Hughes, which are coming out in special editions from Universal Studios, Universal Home Video. So that would be 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, and Weird Science. And the guests that we have booked so far, pending some more, we're going to have casting director Jackie Birch, who basically discovered the quote-unquote Brat Pack.
Mm-hmm.
That she casted the first three films. She casted 16 Candles. She casted Breakfast Club and Weird Science. So, you think about all that, I mean, it's a pretty amazing group of people. I mean, even 16 Candles has a very young John Cusack.
Yeah,
that's right.
She's cast a lot of movies. She would go on to cast Die Hard and Dick Tracy and one of Jamie's all-time favorites, Commando.
yes.
Commando is one of the greats.
It is one of the greats.
I mean, you know what? That's another. Aaron, you and I were talking about...
underrated film that we should try to highlight.
Yeah, and I want to do Clean and Sober. I want to get Glenn Gordon Caron and Keaton on here and Kathy
and,
Baker.
I mentioned Stepfather. Which is,
Stepfather is a good one. And Commando. But that's appreciated, I think. I think that's maybe.
I don't know. We'll work on it. If nothing else, we're going to have Robert Davi on soon on this show, and so we can talk about Red Heat.
Robert Davi and Chaz Palminteri we're working on for November.
Yeah. Also on so we have Jackie Birch, who's basically discovered the that generation of stars, which so I'll be talking to her. That'll be great. And a big coup, one I'm really excited about, going to have legendary film editor Dee Dee Allen.
Yeah.
The Hustler.
Cool, great. That's awesome.
Bonnie and Clyde, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Red, Mike Murder, Wonder Boys, and she edited The Breakfast Club. So she's going to talk about that. So we're going to have an Academy Award winning legendary editor, Dee Dee Allen, on the show to talk about editing The Breakfast Club. So I'm really excited. We have some other guests that are pending, hopefully. And so it's just going to be a tribute show to these first three John Hughes films. Possibly going to end the show with a critical analysis with a film critic. I was trying to find someone to do the pro and defend the first three John Hughes films, but I'm having trouble finding that person. But I do have the quote-unquote neutral/con person to kind of be kind of antagonistic about these first three films. So if I don't find anyone, I will be happy to defend the first three John Hughes films.
Yeah.
Against
I want to hear a throwdown. You know, that's what.
Yeah.
That's
who,
what
who is want. Who is going? Who is the neutral or con?
It looks like pending confirmation. It looks like it'll be Glenn Kinney, formerly of Premiere.com.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Cool. All right.
So we'll get. So I'll be getting it on with Glenn. critically,
in an adversarial sense.
In an adversarial
sense. Let's make that clear.
And speaking of Glenn Kinney, I guess I want to take – so, once again, that'll be a John Hughes tribute show, be an all-out blast, September 18th, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. Please do turn in. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about these first three landmark teen films from the early to mid-'80s.
Exactly.
And speaking of
Glenn Kinney – and listen to me on your show from last week.
Yes, and listen, I do want to say thank you for Jamie for filling in at the last minute. Had a family emergency came up, and Jamie filled in and did better than I could have imagined, interviewing writer-director Tom Holland in conjunction with this new Child's Play 20th Birthday Chucky Edition, which you can listen to that on the Back by Midnight homepage. And it's a
Every once in a while, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, a great interview. But I guess I want to take this moment before we head on out, to mention, because Glenn Kinney did edit some of his stuff when he contributed to Premiere some great articles, the unfortunate and untimely passing of David Foster Wallace.
It's awful.
It's awful.
Awful, awful. This guy, I mean, his wife came in and hung himself. And he's only 46.
Only 46.
And a genius.
Tell me about this. I read the headline.
David Foster Wallace, one of the great writers of our the last, I guess, 10 to 15 years.
Infinite Jest.
Infinite
one
Jest.
I know
one
bad.
Of those, like A Brief History of Time, one of those books that millions have bought and thousands have read. And those who have read it have come away changed. But he also, for a short time, he contributed very lengthy and memorable articles to Premiere Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
One that you can find online if you just Google it is his amazing profile of David Lynch.
Didn't he have that in...
in one of his compilations.
Yeah, a fun thing I supposedly won't do again or something.
Right,
or
a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. Mm-hmm. You'll find the version of this article, but you can also find it online for free. It's
okay.
Called David Lynch Keeps His Head, and David Foster Wallace got free access while Link was filming Lost Highway. And
right.
It's just a great profile of David Lynch. It is one of the best profiles of Lynch I've ever read, and it's just
terrific. I was going to make light of something. I'm not going to do that.
It's just one of these things. My brother came up and told us last night. He was and he just said David Foster Wallace committed suicide. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was just, I mean, between that and, you know, Gregory MacDonald died this week, the guy who wrote the Fletch books. I mean,
right.
We have, like, two great authors this week, so.
Yeah, but really before his time you know, and.
Oh, way before his time.
I think that's really, it epitomizes who an artist is, you know, and it goes, you know, the true artists from the ones that aren't, because it goes deeper than recognition, than popularity,
mm-hmm.
than sales. I mean, an artist uses his form to express something a lot deeper because they have to. And you know, and a lot of times they do suffer depressions and you know, rough patches. And you know, we pray for that family. It's terrible.
Yeah, I was a fan of David Foster Wallace, more so than I ever was of Thomas Pynchon, who we always got compared to. I always thought Wallace was far deeper and more eloquent. One of the best remembrances of David Foster Wallace is at Glenn Kinney's blog, somecameRunning.typepad.com, and Glenn edited a lot of his articles that appeared in Premier.com, in Premier Magazine, that is. So I'd suggest, I'd advise people to read that.
Yeah. All right, buddy. So Thursday night, we will be looking out for you.
All right.
God, I hear this lady screaming in my ear 60 seconds. It's ugly. This British lady, she sounds like a dominatrix. It's kind of sexy. All right.
All right.
We will see you guys Wednesday night when we have two great guests that I will announce Wednesday night. Enjoy your week, everybody. We'll see you midweek.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
See you guys. Bye, Aaron. Bye, Jerry.
Bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.